At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Welcome to JS on Politics. I'm your host, Greg Borowski. It's 4:14, which means it's Milwaukee Day, but we're going to take this show statewide and even national today. So let's take a look at what we've got on our agenda. We'll start with the Russ Feingold-Ron Johnson rematch, which is already hitting the airwaves. Then we'll look at Paul Ryan, who tried again to get his name out of the presidential mix. The actual presidential candidates are in New York, where everything is bigger, including the stakes. We'll preview Tuesday's primary there. Then we'll look at a host of other stories in the news, including the battle for Milwaukee Common Council president and a challenger for State Senator Lena Taylor. And, of course, we'll take some viewer questions, so please send those in. But we're going to start with our panel. We've got Bill Glauber, who's been covering the U.S. Senate race, Dan Bice, our Watchdog columnist. And let's look at that U.S. Senate race, which is already amped up. It didn't take long after the primary last week. Bill, give us your sense of where the race is right now. Who's got the edge, you know, at this moment, looking ahead?
Right now, the latest poll showed Feingold up about 5 points. That's down from a double-digit lead. Sounds about right, considering that there was an amped-up Republican electorate for the primaries. The air war has begun. It's going to be long and loud, and it started with an ad last week from Americans for Prosperity, a biographical ad on Ron Johnson, and then this week a super PAC associated with Johnson or supporting Johnson went up with an ad attacking Russ Feingold, and then Russ Feingold came up with his own ad, which sort of was one of those Back to the Future ads. Right. Instead of going for the garage door, he went for the front door.
Yeah, what's your sense, Dan, of how is this race shaping up now? It's the big one on our radar screen for the fall.
It is. And just to be clear, it didn't just start. These outside groups have been airing ads since June of last year, and they've already spent millions of dollars on the race. But there was, like, everybody took a deep breath, and there was this break between the primary in February and the general election, and it seems like everything has started up again. And for the next 4 or 5 months, this will be the main race in Wisconsin.
And to roll back to 2010, that race did not get started until May of that year.
Of the election.
This has already been going for about a year.
Right. And the candidates are raising themselves. They're raising millions and millions of dollars. It's going to be an expensive race as long as it stays close. And it's important for Johnson to keep it close so the outside groups continue to fund ads, because he himself hasn't gone up on air yet.
All right, well, let's take a look at a couple of these ads. The first one we're going to look at is from former Senator Russ Feingold, and we'll look at that ad right now.
I visited all 72 counties, meeting people, listening to what they have to say. And I'm still at it, so if you hear a knock on your door, it might just be me.
Russ Feingold.
Thank you.
I believe being a representative, the first thing is to talk to the people.
Oh my goodness.
Come on in.
So, Richard, what's your hope?
Well, I'd like to see an economy that in which there are jobs for my daughters and other young people who are starting out in life.
That's getting harder and harder to get ahead.
One of the things that we're really concerned about right now is how are our grandkids and even our kids, how are they going to make it? How are they going to have the life that we've had?
Yeah, we don't need an economy that just works for CEOs. We need an economy that works for middle class and working families.
Absolutely.
If you're going to represent people, you don't tell them what they think. You go and listen to them. That's how it starts.
I'm Russ Feingold, and I approve this message.
It's kind of a folksy Feingold. It is folksy best, right? He's knocking on doors, telling people he's visited all 72 counties.
It's an update on his 92 ad where he, you know, where all of his ads were somewhat humorous and light. This one's not that, but more folksy and so forth. You get him, put him in the flannel shirt and send him around the state.
Why does he need, for someone who was in the office for so many years, does he need an introductory video?
Well, you know, he was voted out of office, so they probably thought, you know, they need to reintroduce him, and he's, you know, he's not a senator anymore. They're running him as Russ,
not three times U.S. Senator Russ Feingold. So I think that's why they did it the way they did.
Plus, you know, all of these outside groups are running ads that turn him into a straw man, so their attempt is to turn him back into more of a fuller character, more of a fuller person.
Do you think that's how people will... I mean, is that what people remember? I mean, after 6 years or almost 6 years, it's a long time. Is that what people remember of Russ as sort of his folksy image, or are people remembering more his policy positions? And
well, it depends what on, they did, depends like on who's better at selling their message. I mean, you will see this. I mean, their second ad that we're going to talk about is an attempt to attack him on his foreign policy positions and to attach him to President Obama. So, you know, he's going to try to present himself as a maverick who's his own guy. And it'll be an interesting debate over the Patriot Act because he was the only senator to vote against it. To him, that's a good thing. On the other side, that's not a good thing.
Yeah, well, let's try to take a look at that ad now because you've hit on some of the points already. This ad is from one of the outside groups called the Let America Work PAC.
Obama's foreign policy is weakness, but not to Russ Feingold.
He is going to be a very important president in our history with regard to foreign policy.
Very important. How about very weak? And Feingold was the only senator to vote against the Patriot Act. Now weakness has brought terrorists to America, putting us all at risk.
He is going to be a very important president in our history.
Russ Feingold, a risk we can't afford again. Let America Work is responsible for the content of this advertising.
So this is one of these many outside groups getting engaged. What do we know about this one, if anything? Are they still under the radar?
No, this is not an under-the-radar group. This is a group that is explicitly backing Ron Johnson. Some of the folks who were involved in Johnson's 2010 campaign are involved with this group. No, this is a legitimate ad by a group that's going to be very
active.
It's
a super PAC.
Yeah, it's a super PAC. Okay. And it's going to be – this group is going to be very active in this campaign. Johnson is trying to run a campaign based on security, economic security, and national security. So this ad sort of, you know, dovetails with that.
Yeah, well, it picked up, as you mentioned, Dan, the vote for the Patriot Act, or, I mean, against the Patriot Act from Russ Feingold. Is that still a powerful thing as you hear about terror in the world,
well, you know,
ISIS, and all the things that
one interesting thing about today? Having these outside groups come in here, sometimes they don't know how they don't know the lay of the land. And in this particular case, President Obama is a popular figure in Wisconsin. He's over 50% in his favorabilities. This ad assumes that the audience doesn't like him, and you know, there's no primary, so maybe this is an attempt just to make sure you get out the troops and rally people behind Johnson. But yeah, it's a little bit odd in that way. But I don't think Feingold's going to hide from the fact that he was the only senator to vote against it.
No, I think his attitude is bring it on. I was right with that with that stance. The other thing that took place this week was fundraising. We learned about Johnson's fundraising. About $2 million, that's what the campaign said. For the fourth straight quarter, they're behind Russ Feingold in fundraising. And, you know, they had to put out a memo about the fundraising and what they saw as a way forward for their campaign. I don't know, as a campaign manager, if you like to do that, because, you know...
Who actually reads those? We get them periodically. I mean, we read them, right? But, I mean, it's sort of basically to sway the view of
right.
the reporters and people writing about the race.
It's like a movie that's not getting good reviews, and you try to get out in front of it by putting an ad before the ad's even out on the street. And in this particular case, as Bill said, they've trailed each of the past four quarters behind Feingold in terms of fundraising. The question is going to continue to be raised, does Ron Johnson put any of his money into this race?
What I found interesting about the memo is they see it as a year of outsiders and that Ron Johnson, a sitting U.S. senator, is an outsider. I don't know, can you really be an outsider with a sitting U.S. senator and a three-time U.S. senator? I don't know
I
how
guess
that
we,
works.
We will find out over the course of the next few months. We're going to end that discussion there and turn now to the national level with this tape segment looking ahead at some of the presidential campaign and some other national issues. We're joined now by Craig Gilbert, our Washington bureau chief, to talk a little bit about happenings in Washington, and in particular with news in the past week about Wisconsin's big three on the Republican side, Paul Ryan, Reince Priebus, and Scott Walker. So, Craig, let's start with Paul Ryan, who had his, you know, sort of no means no, just say no, got off my lawn news conference this week saying I don't want to be picked as president in a brokered convention. Do you think this will put that to bed finally, or will people still be looking for some other person?
I think you put it to bed as much as it can be put to bed. It's always going to be out there because of the bind that the Republican Party is in, and the fact that both leading candidates, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, have a lot of opposition in the party. There's a lot of fear about a train wreck election in the fall. So it's always going to be out there. But I think Paul Ryan has understood for some time that it's hard for him to function as Speaker and as someone who's going to be co-chairing the Republican National Convention when all this speculation is out there and when people think that there's this plan B of him swooping in as the so-called white knight and being the guy that a deadlock convention turns to. So he gave it his best shot. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, so what is he positioning himself to do? I mean, he certainly wants to be influential in the campaign, right, and setting the agenda for the party.
So I think more broadly, he's positioning himself to some degree as a counterpoint to Donald Trump, particularly if Donald Trump is the nominee. Different tone, different message, different messenger. I think he sees himself long-term as a central voice in the Republican Party. He wants to influence the direction and the tone of the Republican Party. He obviously is thinking about, you know, working with whoever the nominee is, and he's talked about providing a policy agenda that that nominee will inherit. It gets really problematic if that nominee is Donald Trump in particular, because they have some big disagreements on policies. I mean, and so Paul Ryan himself is a little bit out of step with the Republican base on some issues like trade and immigration. But, you know, he's thinking ahead to the fall. He's thinking ahead beyond the fall. He is the most powerful Republican in Washington right now.
All right, let's shift to Reince Priebus, who's the chair of the Republican National Committee. And, you know, there have been some columns and things written questioning, you know, is Reince Priebus sort of up to the task here of a, you know, brokered convention and keeping the party together for the fall? I mean, you know Reince pretty well. What do you think he's up to the task, and how is he, you know, framing himself?
Well, so, I mean, it's natural for him to be the target of that kind of criticism, given all the disarray within the party right now. But it probably overstates what a party chairman can do. I mean, a party chairman's principal goal is to raise money, and he actually has done that. It's also to kind of provide an infrastructure for the next nominee, you know, ground game, voter ID, the technology and the analytics, which he's doing. You can criticize how, you know, how he's handled Trump. He's tried to sort of keep peace, but I don't think you can say credibly that Scott Walker, I mean, that Reince Priebus, you know, single-handedly could have altered the course of this nominating fight. And I think that's kind of what the criticism is missing.
All right, let's turn now to the third of the three, Scott Walker, who found himself back in the news when Donald Trump, of all people, said, you know, I could see Scott Walker as my potential running mate, which Scott Walker, of course, said, well, I can't even fathom that. So rather than that little side bit, I mean, how do you think the governor has sort of come out of this situation? He sort of crashed and burned his campaign in the fall. Has he positioned himself well enough and, you know, regained some of that, you know?
I mean, he did salvage something out of the Wisconsin primary in endorsing Ted Cruz and kind of putting his weight behind Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz obviously went on to a big victory, a double-digit victory in Wisconsin, which may or may not be a turning point in the race. I mean, you know, the fact is that it's amazing as these – we'll talk about this a little bit more, but you move from state to state. You know, people think of these races in terms of momentum, but it's really moving from one, you know, kind of political turf to another, and you can go from a state that's great for you to a state that's horrible for you. So it wasn't just Scott Walker that made this a hard state for Donald Trump. But more broadly, I think, you know, he still has the challenge of sort of figuring out what he's going to do with his second term. And the problem is, I think, as a future presidential candidate, is if he couldn't succeed under the best of all possible conditions, which was coming off all these election victories in Wisconsin and being kind of this hero of the recall fight, then, you know, what's his second act? And he's going to need one if he wants to run again nationally.
All right, well, let's turn now to what's ahead on the presidential calendar, and that's New York on Tuesday, where Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are ahead in the polls and the Democratic candidates debate tonight. So talk a little bit, if you could, about the different, you know, demographics and dynamics of that race versus Wisconsin.
Yeah, so as bad as Wisconsin was in so many ways for Donald Trump, it's even worse for Ted Cruz. New York is worse for Ted Cruz. I mean, Ted Cruz is just not the profile of a New York Republican. I mean, he's from Texas. He's a social conservative, which is not again, where the Republican Party in the northeastern United States is at. And he sort of used this notorious phrase of New York values to attack Donald Trump earlier in the campaign. That's been thrown back in his face. It's just a terrible state for Ted Cruz, and it's obviously Donald Trump's home state. So again, you know, you go from benefiting in Wisconsin from this great confluence of factors, from the profile of the state, from local politics to the political players to Donald Trump's vulnerability in the state. And he goes to New York, and there's just nothing. New York just doesn't have a whole lot to offer Ted Cruz. And then it gets really interesting after New York, because you get states like Pennsylvania and Indiana, which collectively, you know, pose challenges to both candidates.
Yeah, well, let's look at the other side of the ticket a little bit, too, because they have their debate tonight, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Is there any hope or chance that Bernie Sanders could upset Hillary Clinton in New York? I mean, she's got plenty of ties in that state as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit volatile and unpredictable. I mean, it's what's tough for Bernie Sanders in New York, if you compare it, for example, to Wisconsin, is that it's a closed primary, which means people register by party, and you have to be a registered Democrat to vote in the Democratic primary. And Bernie Sanders has just done so much better in open primaries because of his appeal to independents. So that's a big hurdle for him to climb. You know, he's not going to repeat the Wisconsin scenario. Whether he can pull off an upset or not, you know, who knows? It's been a volatile year. There have been some surprises, even in states where the polling was all pointing in one direction going in. So I think it would be, you know, a bigger deal certainly for him to win New York than it was for him to win Wisconsin, given the where the expectations are at, given the number of delegates. He still faces a lot of tough delegate math.
All right. Well, that's where we'll end our discussion for today. When we get to our show next week, another state will be in the books, and we'll be able to look back at New York and see what that does to the field. So thanks for joining us today, Craig.
Great.
All right, we're back live. Now we're going to turn to some state and local issues. We're joined by Mary Spicuzza on at the table here, and we have Patrick Marley from Madison. And we're going to start with a question for Patrick about the ruling this week on the right-to-work law, which sort of follows a pattern of other initiatives that pass the legislature, get signed by Governor Walker, they get challenged, and they get set aside. So what's the status on the right-to-work measure?
Yeah, so the Republicans in the legislature passed Right to Work last year. That says that unions and businesses can't have contracts that require all workers to pay union fees. There's a way for workers to exempt themselves. Challenged in Dane County Circuit Court on Friday, a judge here struck down the law. It's sure to be appealed, likely to head to the state Supreme Court. And it would appear that the supporters of Right to Work have a good chance of getting it restored.
It would appear.
Well,
I mean, there's a lot of states out there that have these laws, right? It's not uncharted territory that we're in on that one. Right?
And the state Supreme Court obviously leans conservative and would probably favor this law.
I mean, we've done this before on Act 10 and any number of other things where, I mean, the lawyers are happy because they get to bill for all this stuff, but it goes to Dane County Court. Dane County Court says, whatever, we don't like this, sets it aside, goes to an appeals court, and then finally Supreme Court affirms it.
All right. Well, let's talk about another issue that sort of followed that pattern and now has this extra wrinkle. So, Patrick, tell us about the voter ID, where there was a ruling this week, and that, of course, was ultimately upheld and put in place, and now there's an extra little wrinkle on that measure.
Yeah, so voter ID, like these other laws we were talking about, voter ID passed in 2011, approved in 2014 by the courts, upheld in court challenges. So in one of those cases, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago upheld Wisconsin's law. It went back to the trial court, and the ACLU, which is bringing that case, argued that there are some people who have extreme difficulty in getting IDs, people who maybe their birth certificate was lost in a fire, or they have some kind of error on their birth certificate and it doesn't match their true name and they can't get an ID, or they're caught in some kind of sort of bureaucratic mess where the DMV won't give them a license without a Social Security card and the Social Security agency won't give them a card without them having a photo ID. And so that went back to the Seventh Circuit. The Seventh Circuit said that the case can proceed, that those people should have a way to vote or appear to create the path for those people to get a vote. And now it goes back to Judge Adelman in Milwaukee for proceedings. But the Seventh Circuit has sort of signaled that they see a means for getting people who cannot get IDs to make sure that they can vote.
Let me ask at the table, or just a sense from last week's election, was it a test for how that law worked? There wasn't a lot of, you know, outrage or
There weren't many complaints about it. The one issue that came up was that there were long lines, particularly near college campuses, where students hadn't registered before. And the response has been, we either need more poll workers, we need to plan better for this, or three, which would be the most interesting one, get rid of same-day registration. And so I think it would be interesting in the fall where you're going to have even more people voting.
Right. Well, that same-day registration, that's come up in the past, and then there's been pushback on that, and people have distanced themselves. Do you think that's a real option, Mary, or is that it could solve the same-day registration lines because there would be no same-day registration, but is that really something we would be seeing?
Obviously, conservatives still control the governor's mansion and the legislature, so I can see maybe they would take another swing at that. I think there would be huge pushback and a lot of criticism if they try it. So do you do that before an election? I don't know. Obviously, they're not in session, so it's not going to be
And people
before.
Stuck it out. I mean, I know my daughter, who's a college student, she stood in line for more than an hour to go ahead and vote for the first time, and she said everyone around her stuck it out and did it. But, if it's a race where there's maybe less motivation, I think it would be more of a problem.
I can't see them calling a special session to do that.
Yeah. Well, if you've got your phone
One thing I'd say on that is that the likelihood that they change the law between now and the election is extremely slim because they're not in session and nobody's expressed any desire to come back. Republicans control the legislature. They've always been skeptical of same-day registration. After each election, they question whether to do it. But they've been in control for 5 years. They haven't done it. The thing that really gives them pause is that Wisconsin is exempt from the motor voter law, which says that whenever you go to have an experience at the DMV, when you go get a license, you're supposed to be signed up to vote. Wisconsin doesn't have that in place because we have same-day registration. If we get rid of same-day registration, we will have motor voter. That means people will be offered to register to vote when they get licenses, also when they get welfare benefits, when they get food stamps. Republicans aren't crazy about that idea, and so they've always decided to stick with same-day registration instead.
All right. Well, we'll shift topics now to Mary and the Milwaukee Common Council president race. We talked about this a little bit last week in the battle between Michael Murphy, Tony Zielinski, and really Ashanta Hamilton. What's the latest on that?
Alderman Murphy, the current president, said that he is confident he has the votes to remain president. We'll find out on Tuesday if that's the case. Supposedly there's been some discussion behind the scenes that would make Ashanta Hamilton the new president. I don't know whether or not he has the votes. Probably both of them don't. So we'll find out Tuesday morning. They'll have to be pretty quick because that is Mayor Barrett's inauguration, too.
Yeah, have you heard anything on that front, Dan, in terms of, we've seen these battles before. So usually it should be a simple deal to cut, right? If Tony Zielinski and Ashanta Hamilton together have enough more votes than Alderman Murphy,
you have to think the mayor would be happier with Michael Murphy in charge. It's been pretty smooth the last few years with him as council president. Not that it was bad before with Willie Hines, but I think Tony Zielinski would clearly challenge the mayor on a number of issues. So the mayor says he's not getting involved. But you would expect that he would be happier with Murphy.
All right. Let's speaking of some battles and who's happy and who isn't happy with each other. Let's look at State Senator Lena Taylor, who got a challenger this week.
Right. And it had been talked about for a couple of months that Mandela Barnes was going to challenge her. And it is an interesting race because even though Lena doesn't have a lot of support maybe outside of her own district, she does in the black community have fairly strong support. And you can see that in the little dust-up that she had with Chris Larson during the county execs race, that both black newspapers, the Community Journal and the Courier, came out on her side, criticized Chris Larson, and didn't endorse him as a result of the fight between the two of them, in which Chris Larson said that she was crazy and that that she should have asked her if she had taken her meds that day. And you can bet that Chris Larson is going to be behind Barnes in the race against Lena. So this has been a long-standing fight between Larson and Lena Taylor. He removed her from the Joint Finance Committee, and when he was asked during a debate just a couple months ago why he removed her from the committee, he gave a pretty succinct answer. He said, I don't like her. And that didn't
go
well.
Who says there's no honesty in politics? Patrick, let me ask you, in Madison, from your vantage point there, what why is she drawing the challenge? Is it simply people don't like her? Are there some policy things that Lena Taylor has supported where that she would get a challenge like this in her district?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the people supporting Barnes point out some things where they think that they see room to really appeal to base Democrats and progressives, and that's things like concealed carry. Senator Taylor has been for concealed carry. Some other guns issues. I think she was one of the co-sponsors of the Castle Doctrine bill. And then school choice is something where Barnes is more against it than Senator Taylor. She's shown some support for the voucher program to the frustration of Democrats.
You know, and the thing is, Larson likes to get involved in these other races, and he has shown that he can win primaries in Milwaukee. He's won his own, and then he's won in other races, even challenging incumbents. So he knows how to do that. So it'll be interesting to see how he does that in this particular race. And just to point out, this will be only one of one. There's another Senate race, Senator. Nakia Harris-Todd has already announced that she's not running for re-election, so there'll be a race for that. And then with Barnes stepping aside, there'll be a race for his seat as well. So it has a trickle-down effect in these other races.
Larson did have some problems with the primary up for Dale Schultz's seat, though, where when he was minority leader and they thought that was going to be a Dem seat, he backed a young candidate instead of Ernie Whitwer, the longtime kind of local guy, and got a lot of blowback.
That's
and
what I said.
Losing.
He knows how to win primaries in Milwaukee.
Right.
There's important qualification,
including his own.
Statement.
He beat Abley in the primary, but not so well.
Let's talk about Rick Wiley, a familiar name that we haven't heard from since last we heard from him. It was spending Scott Walker's campaign to the very end,
and now
he's back.
I've seen him twice as an expert on CNN on the presidential race.
What's he doing? He's joined the Trump team.
He did. He's just been hired. But Donald Trump just hired him as his national
political director.
And he's going to be dealing with the states and making sure that, building up the connection. Trump has taken this past week and a half since the Wisconsin primary, slowing things down, having fewer events and reassessing where he is and attacking Republicans in Colorado and elsewhere.
Right. Part of the challenge was, he hasn't been getting the delegates when you get to that next layer, and I think that's what he thinks Rick Wiley might be able to help him with.
Because he has connections with Republicans all over the place. He had a similar position with the National Republican Party, and before that was executive director of the Republican Party here.
All right, let's go now to our viewer questions. We've got several that came in, and I want to start, I want to throw the first one to Patrick. This is from Jim Bob, who says, who is more likely to run for president in 2020, Scott Walker or Paul Ryan? We haven't heard the last of either one, I'm sure, but who do you think would be more likely to jump in something like
well,
that?
Well, it depends who wins the presidential election this year, right? If Ted Cruz or another Republican is president, then neither Scott Walker nor Paul Ryan runs. Both of them have that option available to them if they want to run. I think Paul Ryan would be a little better situated just where his standing is. Scott Walker would have the challenge of, the presidential run he did conduct did not go well. I think there's an opportunity for him to, reboot, but he would have a lot of questions coming out of the gate, whereas Paul Ryan is a little bit of a Republican rock star at the moment. But either of them have that option open to them. It would, just like this time, I think it would be extremely unlikely for both of them to run.
All right. Well, I was just going to say that the both of them came under the national spotlight when Ryan ran for vice president and Walker for president, and I think that Ryan emerged better from that, fewer bruises, fewer problems than Scott Walker did.
Let me ask this question. I'll throw this one to Dan. This is from Milltown, who says, so Chris Abley spent millions of dollars to buy a job. Is it really worth it, or does he have some other angle? So how much did he end up spending, and what is that job
worth? Well, we know he spent $3.5 million, but he certainly, like a lot of politicians, backloaded it. He also, there was a third-party group that no one knows who funded it as well. The guess is that it'll be $6 or $7 million total that he will have spent for a job that pays, what is it, like $140? But for him, it was clearly worth it. He started spending big right out of the box. After the primary, people were saying that Abley was not the type of person who could run for governor as a result of losing to Larson in the primary. But I think I've heard him back in the conversation already. Is he someone who should do this? The only problem is this is another race where some of his flaws were brought to light, including the fact that he didn't have a real base in Milwaukee And then secondly, he didn't come off as a very appealing candidate. He ends up moving ahead and winning the race by attacking his opponent, not by selling his own agenda.
Yeah. All right, let me throw this next question to Mary. This is from Curious Cat, who says, does the high turnout last week really help Ron Johnson in November? And that goes to that question of presidential years tend to favor Democratics. Candidates in statewide elections.
Right.
So this boost, what does Ron Johnson need turnout-wise for him to be successful?
I think in a presidential year that high turnout is going to favor Russ Feingold, honestly, because it's a lot of voters who are just presidential year voters who tend to be Democrats, students, voters in Milwaukee. So I don't think that necessarily high turnouts are going to benefit Ron Johnson.
Obviously, Waukesha, Republicans voted.
1.1 million Republicans voted, 1 million Democrats voted. But there's a sense of inevitability on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, there were a number of Republicans here who felt like they were on a mission, that they were trying to accomplish something. They needed to stop Trump. So I think there was greater enthusiasm to get out to the polls last week.
All right. And lastly, we had a question from Biker who said, I feel like I'm obligated to this, is will there be a chance in heck of you guys actually addressing truthful facts rather than political talking points? But we're out of time, so we can't answer that one. Biker, we'll be back next week, though. And in the meantime, you can follow us.
We didn't get talking points on that.
We didn't get to. Yeah, we'll get them out for next week. Join us next week at the same time and same location for our next week's episode. Thank you.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.